SMA News Today, daily digital coverage of spinal muscular atrophy.
Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 4. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Joining us today is Dr. Danielle Shapook, a clinical psychologist with SMA, who is also a renowned expert on the subject of dating and disability. Originally from Scranton, Pennsylvania, Danielle has spent the better part of her adult life in New York City. It's here that she received her PhD in clinical psychology from the New School for Social Research in 2009, and has since furthered her own practice. Danielle, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Absolutely. This will be a lot of fun. So we'll be talking today about Danielle's day-to-day life, her career, and about the social impact of her work. So to start off, Danielle, if you could just tell us a little bit about your daily life between work and your social life in New York, what does a typical day of the week look like for you?
I think this is a really excellent question. I don't think anyone has asked me this specifically this one in any of the interviews I've done. And I think it's such an important one because between work and living daily life, working full-time with a disability and living in Manhattan, I think it's something people wonder about. So I'm glad you brought it to the table. So,
sure.
Yeah. So basically I spend a lot of my day working, and I guess I use that word loosely, the word working, because it is my career, but at the same time, I enjoy what I do. I love it very much. And it's just really intrinsically rewarding. I feel like I was actually born to do what I'm doing. So even though it's work. So I have my own private practice, and I see clients throughout the day, and my clients have disabilities, and I also have clients that do not. So it's like a 50-50 practice. And right now it's really growing and it's going strong. And I think part of the success of that is that I see my clients via Skype, mm-hmm. which I originally did it this way to make it easier for people with disabilities to come to therapy, you know, because we have, I mean, just speaking from an SMA perspective, for this podcast, it's more difficult for us to travel. We often need someone to take us. The lack of privacy is all kind of wrapped up in there. Like, maybe you don't want to say, drive me to my therapist's office. So Skype makes it so much easier because you could just say, I'll be right back. I'm going into my room and I'm going on Facebook for a while. Meanwhile, we're having a private therapy session. So it's really amazing that way. But in the grand scheme of things, after a few years, it's not just easier for people with disabilities, it's actually easier for everyone. So I think it's the way of the future, and the American Psychological Association even called it, they even labeled it now telepsychology. So that being said, it's my practice is doing well, and I'm very busy with that. And I guess the other significant part of my day is doing what I'm doing right now, and that's talking with you and doing this interview, which is very much in line with the second part of my mission, if you will, which is to change the negative, I'll use the word crappy, censor it.
Sure.
Image of people with disabilities, and try and change it into something more accurate, which is people who are sexy and trendy, and I have to use the word glamorous. I know you're a guy, but
it's all good.
But yeah, you get the gist. And I feel like the only way, the most efficient way to do this is through the media. So that's why I'm, of course, more than happy to do this podcast. And I do a lot of other interviews too. And then finally, I definitely try and devote some time to my own dating life and social life. And that's important. It's important to put time into those aspects too, because you know, if you don't put time into it and energy, then they kind of fall to the wayside, and then you don't have that delicate balance of a successful career and a nice, like, extracurricular life, which a lot of people in Manhattan, it's a hard balance. It's easy to get wrapped up into work, 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 make it better, 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 be the best you could be type thing. So, and it's a shame because it's such an amazing city to do fun things in. So I try and take advantage of that. And I guess finally, I try my best to incorporate some sort of physical exercise. As you may know, and maybe many of your listeners, because I've posted it on social media, I've started Spinraza therapy.
Sure.
So I've gone through some injections now. So I try and implement some sort of exercise.
Where are you in that stage with your treatments?
So I finished the 4 loading doses in the beginning of September.
Okay.
And I had the next dose, so the 4-month later dose, right after Christmas.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and so, you know, with adults, they're unsure of what to expect, so we'll see.
Right. Yeah, I actually just finished my loading doses a couple weeks ago, so I'll have got a few months break now between until my 5th dose in, I think, May. Yeah. Or something. But yeah, it is kind of a, you know, I've gotten a lot of those questions as well, you know, what kind of improvements are you seeing? But it is very, you know, time will tell for adults, especially.
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Appreciate it.
And it's nice to have that 4-month break.
Yes.
You know, those 4 loading doses are kind of intense.
It is. It's time consuming and, you know, physically too. Absolutely.
Yeah. The timing is just, you know, so it's just such, so back to back.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I have a lot of my patients have SMA in my practice, and they range in age from teens to in their 40s, and many of them are going through Spinraza.
Sure.
And we're kind of all in that same ballpark phase. You know, no one has been into the whole, like, 6 months after the loading dose type arena. And I see it's pretty much, in my eyes, and I'm not a physician, but it's kind of everyone's, like, across the board, it's kind of the same. Like, people have noticed, like, little differences, nothing like the whole, oh, I could never raise my arm before, and now I could raise it high above
right.
my head. It's more like, well, you know, I feel like I have a little more core strength, or my voice is a little louder, or so I'm hopeful, because apparently they say it takes time. So yeah, even though I'm an adult, I think things are running pretty parallel to what I see in my teens, my clients in my teens,
sure.
in their teens.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it'll definitely be interesting to see kind of what effects it'll have adults across the border, for sure. Kind of along that note, and also getting back to your life in New York. So you're from a small town and you moved to New York as an adult after college. So I'm curious kind of what that transition was like, and especially with the differences in the healthcare systems of those two locations. How has the New York system helped you be much more independent as an adult?
That's a good question. I was definitely ready to move to New York when I did, which was right after I graduated college. And I went to college at it was a local college.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Marywood University. And it was about 20 minutes from my parents' home. And the plan was that was kind of like a stepping stone. I lived on campus, but I was still, you know, close enough to the family. But in hindsight, I feel like I was ready to spread my wings probably earlier than when I first moved to New York. I wish maybe I did that out of like right out of high school, but
sure.
Who knows? You know, maybe I had such a smooth transition to New York because I had that stepping stone. But I was definitely ready, and it was an adjustment to the biggest adjustment I would say would be home attendance, like finding home attendance. Excuse me.
Sure.
The biggest adjustment would be in the area of finding home attendance. So in Pennsylvania, in Scranton, I either had friends of the family who were my helpers, you know, employed by me. And then after I got familiar, like in the first semester of college, then my dormmates became my helpers too. Like all the girls that lived on the same floor as I did.
Right.
So that was really nice to just kind of have a whole bunch of people available. So then in Manhattan, it's different because I'm away now, away from my family, and I hire home attendants off of, I have various resources that I use that I put ads out to find them. So, you know, in that respect, it's kind of always a stranger that I'm getting, but then, you know, you get to know them, and it's so culturally diverse here. So I've had home attendants from around the world basically. And that's really been great to broaden anybody's perspective. And I find that New York State is actually pretty generous with home attendant care hours, as compared to my clients who live in other states. So I don't have a problem getting enough hours that keep me covered, so that I can live independently, because, you know, most people with SMA type 2, which is my type, types are kind of hard to categorize people these days.
It is. It seems I have type 2, but it's also like, it kind of becomes irrelevant, especially at conferences and stuff.
Yeah, right. Right. So I guess, you know, I'm guessing, I need a home attendant basically all the time, because
sure.
Even when I'm sleeping, I need help, with getting comfortable and things like that. So, I find that I feel like well staffed, so to speak. And then I was thinking about this question while we're talking. It's from another interesting perspective. Is New York Manhattan is just such an amazing resource in many ways. And one of those that I'd like to mention is the gynecologist. So listen up, everyone.
Okay.
I'm not going to go into detail, but I mean, just that. So NYU has this program called Initiative for Women with Disabilities, and they have a gynecologist a clinic that only sees women with physical disabilities. And I find that to be a very rare gem. So, and again, this is working with clients all over the United States, having for a female with a physical disability in a power chair to have a good experience with many of them have had bad experiences with gynecologists for the first time, because tying right into what we're talking about today is that people just assume that we're not sexual and that we're not going to have sex, and that's that. So I've had clients where the doctor will say, well, you know, I don't think you really need a full exam. So, yeah, everything looks good. Or I'm not able to do a full exam because of, you know, the way your body's shaped, but that's okay. And it's like, no, it's not okay, really.
Right.
I mean, we need full exams just like any other woman. And we need to be told about what birth controls are out there and how to have safe sex and discuss if we want to have children, and not leave a doctor's office feeling shamed and really, really upset. So again, it's such a gem in New York City, and I wish I could see it elsewhere. So in terms of healthcare systems, that's a really great part.
Sure. I bet. And Yeah, no, I mean, and I've heard just from other states in general, like programs like where colleges have in-home attendance, you know, 24/7 nursing services. You know, that's something that should be, I think, across universities, across the nation and beyond. You know, it's good to see that stuff, things like that, programs like that do exist and that, you know, there's definitely potential for them to be expanded.
Yes.
But
yeah, that is necessary. Yes.
For sure. Well, on that note, just shifting gears a little bit toward your career. So you studied clinical psychology and eventually you became known for your work in examining how disability factors into the world of dating and sexuality. So when did you first become interested in this subject? And then if you can just talk a little bit about, you know, how you became an authority on it.
Yeah, sure. Well, the subject's always been in a spot. Well, let me think. I guess the topic of dating, sex, and disability has always been like swirling around in my mind, I guess, so to speak. And just in high school, I guess in a significant way, I want to say it's been kind of swirling around in my mind. And in high school, it was significant, but in a way where I just kind of felt weird and left out and intimidated by the topic. And it really wasn't until I moved to New York and someone actually encouraged me to go out on a date where things shifted. And that was what, one of my very first roommates in grad school who pushed me to sign up for on Match.com. Mm-hmm. And then I went on, that's when I started going on some dates and I noticed this discrepancy between how hard it was for me versus my, you know, able-bodied peers. And I wanted to fix this problem. Like I wanted to learn more about it and understand it and try and fix it. So it's really a unique combination So being out in the field, so to speak, with my own personal dating experience, and then my studies of psychology and psychological theory, because I was simultaneously going through grad school at the time, it's just a really great combination to do this, to look at this problem in our community, in our society. So and plus I'm outspoken and gregarious by nature. So I've spent just a lot of time in front of the camera growing up. So, you know, as the MDA Goodwill Ambassador, blah, sure. blah. So I was comfortable doing that and I actually love it. And that's the essential piece to this of pushing the message through the media that we are sexual people and it's time for that to be recognized. And that's because I could just say it to my clients and that's great. And that's definitely a part of what I'm doing, but I need to say it to the whole world. So, what's interesting is the whole world is actually listening, which is really, just makes me want to even keep going further. I just received messages from people from everywhere, India, everywhere saying, I saw your TED and I have that problem too. And it's disgusting. It needs to be fixed. Like, how can people think this way? And I agree. So I guess that's the combination that kind of put me on the path to becoming, like really renowned for this topic. Plus also then I've worked with many, many, many clients with physical disabilities about sexuality and dating. So that pretty much illustrates my trajectory.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, you know, I've heard you speak at an SMA conference before and then listened to your TED talk and, you know, read some of your articles and whatnot. And so I was wondering kind of on that note, you know, like, do you have any big projects in mind for the future that you want to do to help, you know, further your message? obviously you've made a big name, you know, and have been doing this for a while now, but do you have any other plans in mind for the future?
Yeah, I always have some plans brewing or some ideas that like take shape or form, but I guess I would say that the main, my main goal, and it's been my goal for a little while now, but I want to take it to the next level, and that's do something television related.
Okay.
Yeah, because I feel that through it's like mass media like that, that really spreads the new image that you and I both know needs to happen.
Sure.
The way we need to be looked at and to get rid of that old antiquated one. So I have a few things in the works in that realm, but that's all I can say about it really. But I hope that, you'll see something on mainstream media, because it just takes seeing either you or I making out with someone on TV for then someone who's never seen anyone in a wheelchair before to say, oh yeah, yeah, I saw that. Like, oh, I saw him making out on someone in a wheelchair, making out with someone. Yeah, no big deal. That happens. That's cool. That's all it takes.
Sure.
So, and of course I always want to write a book. So
that's what I was going to ask too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you should.
Yeah, I definitely want to. I have an idea of how I want to shape it. And I want it to be different than the other literature out there on disability and dating or both. So I'll probably get that ball rolling in a little while.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's interesting because one of my previous guests on this was Ben Matlin, who he's also an SMA writer. He has a new book coming out at the end of this month. It's a series of stories about inter-abled couples. So, you know, where one partner has a disability, the other doesn't. It's really good. That's what I liked about that one, was that it was kind of, you know, instead of just like an extended opinion piece, it was like he really got into the nuts and bolts of like different inter-abled couples and asking them these kind of questions about how they navigate daily life and whatnot. So it was really interesting.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I'm definitely going to take a look at that.
Sure.
And I think on that note, it's important to think about people with SMA and congenital disability versus injury or some sort of spinal cord injury, because there's a lot of books about on spinal cord injury or yes. written by someone with a spinal cord injury, because I feel like they've kind of entered the gateway of acceptance by our society before we have, because I mean, my theory is that they just, you know, since society is very appearance focused, someone with a spinal cord injury looks more like just an able-bodied person just sitting in a wheelchair versus someone like me who has scoliosis or maybe a shortened trunk or, you know, just different. So we have literature out there about spinal cord injury, and that's important, but we need to have literature about congenital disability
yes.
in that perspective. So, because it's not just about, you know, I once walked and then I had an accident and now I don't. I mean, for us, I mean, I'm speaking for you, Kevin.
Yeah.
But
oh, I
for
agree.
Us, I mean, we've known no other way. I mean, this is
right.
life. There really was no grief or loss or mourning process, if you will.
Right.
Like, this is our life. And so I want the book to be, you know, to embrace that perspective as a big part of it. So.
No, I agree. And that's something I've written about too. How, you know, it's almost all, even if you do get a movie or a book about, you know, a disabled character, it's almost always someone who, you know, had an accident versus someone who was born with it. So, but that's also, I don't know if you watched the ABC show Speechless. That one actually does a really good job
yes.
too. Yeah. I really, and
yeah,
actually in terms of exploring inter-abled romance as well, I like how they've explored, you know, just JJ's adolescence and him going through just normal relationships and all that. It's been really fascinating to see that, you know, be so mainstream.
Yeah, I think Speechless is a great show. I think they, even with the, with his home attendant.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I know that show, I know some people, well, a little bit behind the scenes of it, but I know one, they've consulted people who are big in the disability community and in Hollywood. Like, I know Ben Lewin, who directed The Sessions.
Okay.
You know, the movie with Helen Hunt?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He directed one of the episodes of Speechless. They brought him in.
That's
so
cool.
They're serious on getting it right. And it's great that it's going from season to season.
Right. It's good right. to see. Absolutely. You know, and that's the kind of thing I want to see, you know, be great to see more of, you know? Well, and
yes, we meet.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, and on that note, yeah. just kind of wrap up a little bit. So, you know, since writing and talking about this subject, do you have like any personal stories of how you're seeing attitudes about this subject shift, you know, in terms of recognizing individuals with disabilities as capable of romantic relationships? Are there any stories that come to mind, you know, from your career where you've really seen the impact of your work?
Yeah, in many different ways. I guess first and foremost, I see it with, I mean, it's evidenced in the fact that I get asked a lot to do media interviews for big publications. And I think that's a really good sign. It almost says, it's just basically to me saying, okay, America's ready to hear this. They're ready to hear what you have to say. And they always come out in, like, the interviews always come out in a way that I'm happy with. You know, it's not any of the old, they don't try and pull it back to the old, like, oh, I'm sorry this happened to you. Oh my God, you're doing such a good job. You
right.
know, that whole, all that crap.
Yeah.
You know, it comes out just the way I want it to. So that's changed. And the fact that I keep getting asked to do these things shows me that things are moving in that positive direction. And I don't, you know, almost one of the biggest examples of change from my work is with myself, actually, because I've reflected on this a lot, and that's, it's like my own attitude towards dating has changed a
sure.
lot dramatically from when I first began my work. And I guess I could just, I'm not sure how the change even happened, but when I look back to high school Danielle, it's like my inner confidence has grown. Like, my dateable self-esteem, which is a concept I talk about, has increased a lot. My confidence in myself as a dateable person. And it's kind of all part of this it's a psychological concept called radical acceptance. And that's accepting essentially that means it is what it is. So my body is what it is. My disability is what it is. And I'm not hiding it in front of my date.
Sure.
I'm not going to try and like minimize things or gloss them over. Like, I am who I am. And that's interesting, because that's like part, like getting rid of it. It's like anti-ableism, which is great. And then I know what I want and I know what I'm looking for. And so I'm not sure if it's like my work that has changed me, or that society's shifting concept is changing me, or a combo of both. But it's definitely positive. And many of my patients, I tell them to get out there and start dating for whatever reason specifically it is to them. But I tell them to get out there and start dating. And like, the more they do that, the better it is for all of us, even. Because if I'm out there on a date and you're out there, Kevin, on a date, and then someone sees me on a date, someone sees you on a date, that's one that's two more people that say, oh yeah, I saw that. We're not so in the shadows anymore.
Right.
It's like more common and more normalized. It's like, it's such a simple chain of events that can have such a huge impact. And I guess I'll leave it as, leave it with one example of that. And that I have a lot of patients who say when they first start working with me, like it's never going to happen for me, Danielle, like I know it, like no one's ever going to like be able to deal with my disability or love me for it. And then we work together and then, but one day they'll come to me in session and they'll say, hey, guess what? And usually that guess what is, I met someone. Like, you're never going to believe it, but blah, 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 blah.
Right.
You know, so, and it gives me goosebumps to think about it. That's just all the change that I'm seeing. And I always see people with disabilities, like my clients are dating and having hot sex and they're in romantic relationships and they get married. And so it's happening all the time. And it can happen for anyone and everyone if that's what you want.
Sure, absolutely. Well, and, you know, your point about, you know, just the way in which you're interviewed, that makes a big difference that, you know, to see how it is being more normalized and just in the questions that able-bodied interviewers ask you, that alone makes a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah, and usually when the people working on the set of wherever I'm interviewing at, or, you know, behind the scenes, or the cameraman or camera woman, whatever, as soon as they hear what I'm talking about, you know, dating, sex, and disability, they're like, yeah, you're right. I never thought of it before, but yeah, why not? Why don't people consider you dateable? That's ridiculous. Da da da. So it just takes all those, like a little those experiences that even open the door even wider for us to come through.
Absolutely. Oh, I fully agree. Well, is there anything else you want to share before we close out?
Well, I just want to thank you for taking the time to have me on. And it was really nice to be here. And I love, there's this special place in my heart for the SMA community.
Absolutely.
So always. So it's good to be talking to you and who's ever listening today.
Absolutely. No, thank you for joining us today. Just for our listeners out there, so you can find more about Dr. Shapook's work at www.danielleshapook.com. You can also follow her on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Danielle Shapook, and contact her directly at shapook@hotmail.com. That's correct?
That's right.
Awesome. And just for more episodes on the SMA News Today podcast, all episodes are available on SoundCloud, Podbean, and here on our website at www.smanewstoday.com. Be sure to follow SMA News Today for daily digital coverage of spinal muscular atrophy. I'm Kevin Schaefer, community editor. We will see you next time.